Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of racism, murder, violence, sexual assault, genocide, and child abuse.
The colonial world is a world cut in two. The dividing line, the frontiers, are shown by barracks and police stations. In the colonies, it is the policeman and the soldier, or the official, instituted go-betweens, the spokesman of the settler and his rule of oppression. The policeman and the soldier, by their immediate presence and their frequent and direct action, maintain contact with the natives and advise him by means of rifle butts and napalm not to budge. It is obvious here that the agents of government speak the language of pure force. The intermediary does not lighten the oppression, nor seek to hide the domination. He shows them up. Frantz Fanon, 1963. The Nazi hordes had just capitulated. It was Victory in Europe Day, 1945. Massive celebrations were planned all across the French Empire, which dutifully supplied hundreds of thousands of men to fight for mainland France, which had been occupied since 1940. A day which was meant to symbolize the victory of democracy over authoritarianism was, instead, a day steeped in blood. It began in Sétif, a remote mountain town in eastern Algeria. Thousands of Algerians were out in the street celebrating the fall of fascism, as well as the independence they believed they would soon see for their country. It had been hinted at and practically endorsed by de Gaulle in 1943. However, the few policemen in Sétif were jumpy at the possibility of quote-unquote nationalist violence. They decreed that no banners or placards should be too provocative or controversial. For the most part, the people of the mountain town complied, albeit there were a few banners celebrating a quote independent Algeria, as well as white and green flags showcasing a red crescent moon. This would soon become the national flag of Algeria. The way in which the violence began is still debated. Official French reports claim the police commissioner was in the process of removing, quote, offensive banners, unquote, from members of the crowd when he was struck with a stone. The commissioner then pulled out his nightstick to defend himself, when armed members of the crowd began the riot. S.E. Jazayri claims otherwise. He says that a plainclothes French police officer was responsible for the ensuing debacle. He asserts that after leaving a local business, the officer found himself in the middle of an intense but peaceful protest. The officer, quote-unquote, lost his nerve, pulled out his weapon, and put a bullet in the stomach of a young boy carrying an Algerian flag. The senseless killing of the boy provoked a serious anti-European riot. Muslims all across the region killed and assaulted Europeans, regardless of age or fault. Entire towns and businesses were put to the torch. In total, 109 people were killed. Another 100 were wounded, and many others had psychological scars which would afflict them forever. Instead of assuming responsibility for their own actions, which led to this Algerian rising, France doubled down on the force they used against the native population. Senegalese troops were rushed in, and they began a ratissage, or a raking over, of all the nearby Algerian villages. 40 villages were bombed with Douglas aircraft. The French navy ruthlessly shelled villages from the sea, and the French army executed any military-age men they could find. In total, anywhere from 600 to 45,000 people were killed by the French. This is not the only instance in which there is a vast discrepancy between quote-unquote official French numbers and the assertions of the Algerians who lived through this horrific occupation. The fact that these figures vary so considerably is why relying solely on European sources in order to draw conclusions about European crimes is a bad idea. Sétif was not an isolated incident by any means. It was just the tip of the iceberg of French violence. Immediately after hostilities between Abd el-Kadir and the French ceased, the French began setting up their own colonial administration. They separated Algeria into three quote-unquote departments. They were the departments of Oran, Algiers, and Constantine. All of Algeria was then annexed to the French Empire. The natives had no autonomy and were not even considered citizens of France. They were only, quote, subjects of the French king, unquote. Needless to say, every trick, legal and otherwise, was employed to steal the land of the Algerians while claiming it was, quote-unquote, French ingenuity which had turned the desert green. They always failed to mention that the people who were actually working the land were Algerian laborers who toiled endlessly in the hot sun for starvation wages. For 1,300 miles from the city of Algiers deep into the Hoggar Mountains, the French flag flew. The main goal of the French colonizers was to quote-unquote assimilate the cooperative natives and completely destroy or otherwise remove the uncooperative. They elevated the loyal to the position of cadi, making them an integral part of the French administration. When the revolution came, Muslims who chose loyalty to France, known as the Beni Wiwis, which roughly translates to yes men, would be especially targeted by the revolutionaries. The vast majority of French collaborators only held positions of power in the interior, where there were few, if any, Europeans. The majority of the Europeans in Algeria lived along the coast, where they gathered in large numbers in the main cities. Many were Spaniards and Italians who were trying to make a new life. In fact, by 1917, only 1 in 5 of the Europeans in Algeria were originally from France. Anatole France did not hide his discontent with this fact. He said, quote, "We have despoiled, pursued, and hunted down the Arabs in order to populate Algeria with Italians and Spaniards," unquote. These Iberian and Italian immigrants were followed by the Maltese, who spoke a language similar to Arabic, as well as Corsicans and southern French peoples. This last category arrived following a plague which ravaged French vineyards. They turned Algeria into a wine-producing machine. Algerian vines proved they were much more hardy than their French counterparts, and they resisted phylloxera, which had decimated French vines. This industry deeply upset the natives, whose religion forbade them from drinking. It also took away farmlands previously used as wheat fields, which would have been able to feed more Algerians. Today, wine is still produced in Algeria, albeit at a much smaller rate. Instability in the government and the continued interdictions against alcohol consumption have rendered the industry taboo. By 1962, over 1 million Europeans called Algeria home. Amongst them was the famous writer Albert Camus, who occasionally traveled to the interior of the country and was appalled at the poverty and starvation he saw there. While in Kabylia, he witnessed children fighting with dogs over scraps of meat. As horrific as this poverty was, it was an improvement from the famines which had occurred throughout the late 1860s. Within the space of a few years, from 1866 to 1868, many historians contend that hundreds of thousands of Algerians starved to death, as France did less than nothing to help. Many French Algerians, or Pieds Noirs, blamed the Algerians for the famine, claiming they were lazy. The French refused to accept the reality that their own policies were to blame. Land, which could have been used by Algerians to feed their people, now belonged to some massive French company or entrepreneurs who stole the land and used it as they saw fit. Even quote-unquote enlightened liberals like Alexis de Tocqueville argued that Algeria was, quote, sparsely inhabited and had room for French settlement, unquote. The same man argued vociferously for the rights of indigenous people living in North America, as well as Africans who had been trafficked into slavery, but he failed to see the injustice his own country was committing. Using land expropriation laws, which allowed French officials to steal quote-unquote unused Arab land as justification, more and more territory was ceded to the few at the expense of the many. Throughout the famine, there were few Frenchmen who helped suffering Algerians. Many actively took pleasure in their torment. Le Figaro, a conservative paper in France, recalls, quote, certain depraved travelers amused themselves by throwing coppers into thickets of cactus, laughing as the girls emerged with their bronze shoulders covered in blood, paying with their bodies the tax demanded by famine, unquote. Most Frenchmen were repulsed by the sight of the quote-unquote dying hordes, terrified the infirm and dying would spread disease to them. Efforts were made to prevent the spread of disease to Europeans, while native Algerians suffered. The only sympathetic institution was the Catholic Church. As with most things, the Church was only benevolent when it was to their benefit. They almost exclusively gave care to orphaned Algerians. One cardinal explained his reasoning, quote, taken away from the corrupt milieu and raised under new conditions, they, the orphans, would turn into much better people. They shall be industrious, skilled, and shall support French colonization. They shall listen to our words and follow our ways. They shall begin a regeneration of this people. This shall happen as they shall be spared the corrupting effects of the Quran, which teaches that it is meritorious to kill Christian dogs and to throw them into the sea, unquote. As the 1870s began, the situation in Algeria would stabilize, but the situation in France would become very dire. Prussia had defeated the Austrians in the 1866 Brothers' War. Afterward, they formed an anti-French league, remembered as the North German Confederation. Many French military officers believed war with the North German power was now inevitable. Hostilities began in 1870, after France disputed the succession of a German prince to the Spanish throne. France hoped that Austria would join on the French side, but their assistance never materialized, and France found itself in a one-on-one fight with the North German Confederation. Within 6 months, the poorly situated armies of France were routed, defeated, and forced to surrender. The Algerian tirailleurs were some of the only units which remained to face the Germans. At Weissenburg, a French army of 36,000, largely composed of soldiers hailing from Algeria, withstood the combined assaults of over 100,000 Germans. Their staunch defense at Weissenburg and other battlefields took a great toll on Algerian units. For example, the 2nd Turcos Regiment lost 1,900 of their 2,000 soldiers in a single day. Algerian sacrifices were not enough to prevent the fall of the 2nd French Empire and the abdication of Napoleon III. The German Empire was proclaimed from the Palace of Versailles, and the French provinces of Alsace and Lorraine were annexed into this new empire. The French forgot their hatred for Algerians and turned their ire toward their German neighbors. A period of revanchism, or revengeism, began. During this era, French leaders had a sole foreign policy objective: securing the French position abroad in order to wage war and win back territory in Europe. This does not mean that the French Republic ended their occupation of North Africa. In 1882, Tunisia was invaded, and a protectorate was established. A similar French occupation took place in Morocco at the turn of the 20th century. As World War I began, Algeria was called upon to provide troops for the French cause once more. Hundreds of thousands of Algerians fought and died in wretched conditions in some of the most pivotal battles of the Great War. During one of the many battles for the Fort of Douaumont, Algerian soldiers played a crucial role in recapturing it from the Germans. Meanwhile, the 2nd Regiment of Tirailleurs was one of the first Allied units to be gassed at the Battle of Ypres. Algerians fought and died in the thousands for a country whose governing body still considered them inferior in many respects. Many Algerians, and now some Frenchmen, thought this had to change, and Algerian sacrifice only added weight to their argument. The main obstacle to reform were the French Algerians, who were extremely conservative and constantly worried that they would be replaced politically and suffer financially if Algerian natives obtained equal rights under French law. Alastair Horn asserts, quote, "The most obvious kinsmen to the Pied Noir are the whites of South Africa, Rhodesia, and the deep south of the United States. In Algeria, however, there was no form of segregation so overt as apartheid or Jim Crow laws on buses." Unquote. The segregation practiced by France was more focused on economics than on social distinctions. This did not mean there was no racism against Algerians. Slurs like simpleton and little rat were often used by the Pied Noir to describe native Algerians. Jules Roy admitted, quote, "One thing I knew, because I was told so often, was that the Arabs belonged to a different race, one inferior to my own. They don't live the way we do." The sentence drew a chaste veil over their poverty. Yes, their happiness was elsewhere, rather, if you please, like the happiness of cattle. "They don't have the same needs we do," I was always being told. Unquote. The Pied Noir population did not believe or behave this way as a monolith. In fact, there would be several Pied Noir who would play a crucial role in assisting the FLN revolutionaries in fighting for Algerian independence. On the whole, however, the Pied Noir identified with the far right and gained the moniker Ultras for their hard-line stances. Others, like Camus, supported a centrist way of thinking, in which reforms would be granted to the native populations as they, quote-unquote, proved themselves capable. Finally, a smaller segment of Pied Noir supported the far left and the Algerian Communist Party. Communists had various opinions about Algerian independence. On one hand, they wanted self-determination for all oppressed peoples. On the other hand, they wanted Algeria to be prepared for world revolution, and they felt the best way for that to happen was to make sure Algeria was as economically progressive as possible. For this latter reason, many communists were against Algerian independence. It was similar to a problematic argument made by the Polish socialist Rosa Luxemburg, when she favored the continued association of Poland with Germany. This argument makes little sense to me, and it made less sense to Algerian patriots, who largely turned away from communism as an ideology or economic policy, instead supporting a system based in state capitalism. World War I acted as a forge for nationalism amongst colonized people. Besides the early rise of pan-Arabism, individual nations in the Muslim and African worlds founded political movements which were focused on obtaining independence and autonomy. Frequently, these movements were founded and spearheaded by veterans of the Great War, who believed the blood they shed for their respective allied powers would soon translate into independence or some form of autonomy. Unfortunately for the nations throughout the global South, allied powers crafted their treaties without the input of the peoples whose land they were taking. Naturally, this greed devolved into broken promises to the native peoples of the area. This included Algeria, where basic reforms were put off to appease the ultras in the French Parliament. Much like in the southern United States, regional political interests played a decisive factor in national decision-making. This hurt France, Algeria, the French colonizers, and especially the native Algerians. For the first 40 years of French rule in Algeria, the military ran the country. In time, a governor general would be selected. He would report directly to the French Minister of the Interior. For a long time, Muslims were not allowed to vote at all. However, following World War II, a double electoral college system was introduced in which the Pied Noir would vote alongside a select number of Muslims who had shown sufficient quote-unquote loyalty. The second electoral college contained the rest and vast majority of the Algerian population. Administratively, majority Algerian townships and villages were often under-administered. In the Orez Mountains, for example, three French administrators were technically responsible for the welfare of over 60,000 Algerians. Many state functions were unchecked, and projects were never completed. Another impediment to Algerian advancement was their citizenship status. Although Algeria was technically an integral part of France, Algerians were not permitted to be French citizens, unless they first renounced their religion. For obvious reasons, Algerians didn't want to do this. As time wore on, avenues were open to certain Algerians, but in total, only 2,500 Algerians became French citizens by the time of the Sétif massacre. During the French occupation, they implemented mass vaccination campaigns and distributed penicillin. These two factors allowed the population to recover from the genocide the French committed against them. At the start of the war for independence, Muslim Algerians numbered over 9 million. Economically, the wage gap between the average Algerian worker and the average Pied Noir was immense. The average Algerian made just 16,000 francs per year, compared to over 450,000 francs per year for Europeans. Many Algerians were forced into migrating to mainland France, where they faced cultural isolation and racism from French police. In spite of this, they made themselves integral to the French economy, while also assisting their families back in the Maghreb. Prior to the War of Independence, three families controlled most of the industry in Algeria. They all worked in their own way to maintain the French presence there, and for as long as possible. Henri Bourgade was a Swiss man who controlled a wine empire. Over 1,000 hectares of the finest farmland in Algeria belonged to him, and he used it to crank out 4 million liters of wine annually. He was a staunch conservative who, besides being a member of parliament, bankrolled newspapers like the Echo d'Alger, which distributed his conservative message. Ben Tobal, a leader of the Algerian Revolution, quipped, quote, Bogois deserves the title of national hero. Without him and those like him, there would never have been a united Algeria. Unquote. Next, there was Laurent Schifiano. His family was originally from Naples. He ran a shipping empire. Nothing moved without one of Schifano's boats. He was also a politician, and much like Bogois, he was opposed to any form of liberalization or concession to the Algerian natives. His shipping industry was so crucial that following the FLN's revolution, he was asked by the Algerian government to stay. Finally, the only quote-unquote true Frenchman of the group, Georges Blanchet, was known as the, quote, king of alfalfa, unquote. Southern Oran was his domain, and he produced alfalfa, almost all of which was sent off to British paper mills. He was so successful that he accounted for 20% of Algeria's exports. He was a liberal who supported reforms in many areas of Algerian life, save for his own alfalfa fields, in which his workers were some of the poorest paid in the entire country. Finally, the substantial Jewish minority in Algeria would play a crucial role in the revolution. In 1870, they were granted French citizenship, which inspired many Jewish people from Eastern Europe to migrate to Algeria. At the turn of the 20th century, they were subject to a small pogrom by European settlers who felt Jewish merchants and businesses were encroaching on their own profits. They would face horrific and unprecedented atrocities during World War II, but they found solace in the Muslim community, who refused to fall in line with the Vichy government's anti-Semitic decrees. The Jewish community in Algeria largely identified with liberal or socialist ideologies. Individual Jewish people played a pivotal role in gaining Algeria's independence, but they would largely opt to go to France as opposed to remaining in a new Algeria where their nationality would be up in the air. Others left for Israel. Today, just 200 Jewish people remain in Algeria. There were attempts by French authorities to reform the situation in Algeria. Each one was met with desperate resistance from the ultras and their conservative allies in parliament. Each new attempt to reform was also met with a figurative slap in the face by the ignorant French officials. One of the most popular attempts at reform was the Blum-Violette Act. The bill would have granted 25,000 Algerians French citizenship without them having to renounce their religion. The Pied Noir lobby was furious. They fought tooth and nail against the bill, arguing that granting more rights to Algerians would somehow take their own rights away. Léon Blum's Popular Front collapsed before the bill could be passed. Its failure represented a long line of reformist failures since the beginning of the New Republic. An enraged Violette prophetically said, quote, "When the Muslims protest, you are indignant. When they approve, you are suspicious. When they keep quiet, you are fearful. Messieurs, these men have no political nation. They do not even demand their religious nation. All they ask is to be admitted into yours. If you refuse this, beware, lest they do not soon create one for themselves." Unquote. Algerian nationalism took decades to develop. The earliest foundation, the Young Algeria movement, can be traced back to 1919. Similar to the Young Turk movement as well as the Young Italy movement, the Young Algerians and their leader, Amir Khaled, were repressed by the French authorities. Khaled was forced into exile and died in Syria, just like Abd el Kadir. One of the members of the Young Algeria movement, Fahad Abbas, became one of the main voices for liberal reform in Algeria, and eventually an advocate for total Algerian independence. Besides Abbas, there were the revolutionaries led by Massali Hadj. He founded several important organizations which laid the groundwork for the future FLN. Finally, there was the Sheikh, Abdulhamid Ben Badis, who led the quote-unquote religious arm of the nationalists and wanted a return to Islamic governance. His ideas are best encapsulated in the saying, quote, "Islam is my religion, Arabic is my language, Algeria is my country. Independence is a natural right for every people of the earth. Unquote. All three factions of early Algerian nationalism contributed their own gifts to the coming struggle. However, intense antagonism and fundamental differences between these three intersecting movements would prove a difficult obstacle to overcome. The main conflict was between Messali's revolutionaries and Abbas's liberals. The latter, at least at first, wanted Algeria to remain a part of France, but for the metropolis to recognize the uniqueness of Algeria and the rights of Algerians. The revolutionaries couldn't fathom such an agreement, and they argued vociferously for total Algerian independence. As a result, the liberals found themselves ostracized by both the French, who despised them for seeking any sort of reform, as well as their own people, who accused them of collaboration. The failure of the Blum-Violet Bill was the moment Abbas began to seriously reconsider his political stance. He now opted for a form of autonomy still under French control. It would take many years for him to come around fully to the side of revolution. French authorities responded aggressively to the quote-unquote divisive language being spread by people like Badis and Messali. The latter had his organization declared illegal, and he was constantly in and out of French jails. As this occurred, the colonizers continued their steady creep toward economic dominance. By 1940, it's estimated that Europeans in Algeria owned over 2.7 million hectares of land, or about one-third of all the arable land in Algeria. Muslim Algerians found it more and more difficult to stay afloat. Every decade, the size of their harvests and the number of their herds fell. Meanwhile, unemployment and underemployment of Algerians was hovering at just over 90%. The illiteracy rate was just as bad, and for obvious reasons, there were few attempts to correct this. In 1954, only 1% of the Algerian population was attending secondary school. Indignant and inept French officials blamed native Algerians for their quote-unquote backwardness and laziness, knowing full well it was French policy which created such a contrast between the French and native Algerian populations. World War II exposed the inadequacies of French defensive planners. Within 2 weeks, German panzer columns ripped a gaping hole in the French lines around the Ardennes forest and forced mainland France's capitulation. Algeria came under the sway of the Vichy regime, which instituted intense measures to crack down on both revolutionaries and Jewish people. The Jewish population of North Africa was probably one of the most targeted populations. Marshal Pétain, leader of the Vichy regime, was attempting to drive a wedge between the Arab majority and the Jewish minority in the hopes of gaining the trust of the former. Messali Hadj was at the forefront of protesting for Jewish rights. He said, quote, "By taking away the rights of Jews, you are not granting any new rights to Muslims. The equality you have achieved between Jews and Muslims is an equality in degradation." Unquote. While it is true that some Algerians fought for the Nazis, they did so out of disdain for the French. One FLN member considered the Nazis to be a scourge sent by Allah to punish the French for their colonization of Africa. The vast majority of Algerians, however, who fought in World War II, did so on the side of the Allies, shedding their blood in all the major battles where the French were deployed. Whether it was up the slopes of Monte Cassino in Italy, or holding off German attacks as European units folded in the defense of France, it cannot be said that the Algerian people did not fight with everything they had. Numerous Algerians were awarded the Croix de Guerre. Amongst them was Ben Bella, future revolutionary and the first president of Algeria. He won the medal twice. The second time, it was pinned on his chest by de Gaulle himself. In Equatorial Africa, leader of the Free French Movement, Charles de Gaulle, was gathering the remnants of the French army around his banner. Amongst his largely colonial forces were numerous Algerians, who were promised in no uncertain terms that upon liberation they would have autonomy. During a speech in Brazzaville, de Gaulle said, quote, "In French Africa, as in all other territories where men live under our flag, there will be no progress unless the inhabitants benefit materially and morally in the countries of their birth. Unless they can raise themselves up little by little to the level where they are capable of taking part in the management of their own affairs." Unquote. His speech electrified millions of colonized peoples who hoped France's rhetoric would finally match France's actions. Unfortunately, de Gaulle was not entirely honest in his speeches. In fact, he was one of the coldest and most calculating political animals of all time. He clearly needed the French colonies, and especially their manpower, if he wanted to remain in control of free France. He realized the best way to do this was to promise reform, in some fashion, at some unspecified time in the future. De Gaulle would be Prime Minister of France during and following the Sétif riot and the subsequent French Vatissage. He would not remain there for long and left in a fit of frustration in 1946. Following his self-imposed exile from politics, numerous French governments were formed and fell. Like in other European nations, France relied on shaky alliances in parliament, so this resulted in constant shuffling. In Algeria, Sétif had a lasting effect on an entire generation of Algerian nationalists. To many, it was the unofficial beginning of their revolution. Numerous members of the future FLN were radicalized and brought over to the side of violence, strictly because of France's draconian response to Sétif. Perhaps if the French had not been preoccupied elsewhere, Algeria would have remained a part of France. However, in the wake of World War II, France had its hands full on all fronts. In Madagascar, Tunisia, Morocco, the Gambia, and French Indochina, nationalists who were determined to free their respective states began serious armed rebellions against the French administration. Some were resolved diplomatically, as in Western Africa. Others were disputed on the battlefield. In Morocco and Tunisia, determined militant resistance brought independence to both states. In French Indochina, the Vietnamese people displayed their resolve, outlasting Japan in the 1940s before defeating the combined powers of the French in the 1950s and the United States throughout the 1960s and 70s. Most relevant to this story was the French capitulation at Dien Bien Phu in 1953, when Vietnamese General Vo Nguyen Giap proved his troops' efficacy with both siege and infiltration tactics. In total, 13,000 French soldiers died in this single battle. It was as devastating a defeat as the French rout of 1940. Only this time, the defeat was at the hands of people who had long been considered quote-unquote inferior by French authorities. Numerous French officers who saw combat in Vietnam would soon be fighting in Algeria, where they would employ the torture techniques they learned in Indochina against thousands of innocent Algerians. Arab nationalists got together in early 1947 in Cairo, Egypt, for the purpose of opposing the French colonization of North Africa. The organization, sponsored by the Arab League, said they wanted the, quote, "abolition of the French protectorates of Tunisia and Morocco and the non-recognition of French rights in Algeria, the recognition of independence of these countries, the total evacuation of foreign troops, and the refusal to participate in a French union in any form." Unquote. That same year, a new Algerian Bill of Rights, also known as the Organic Statute, was drafted and passed by French Parliament. The few Muslim members of the French Parliament abstained from the vote, and the bill was lambasted by both nationalists in Algeria and conservatives in France. Amongst other things, the Organic Statute gave the vote to Arabic women introduced a separation of church and state and made Arabic an official language alongside French. However, the bill never addressed the undemocratic nature of elections in Algeria, which still greatly favored the votes of the Pied Noir over those of the Algerians. Additionally, the new constitution had a stipulation which made any of these reforms subject to approval by the Pied Noir legislature, ensuring no reform would ever be allowed through. In spite of the provisions and half-measures in this new Algerian constitution, more Algerians than ever were voting, and in the municipal elections of 1947, many of Messali's revolutionaries were elevated to the legislature. This infuriated and frightened many Pied Noir, who felt they would soon be swamped at the polls by Algerians, especially if they were freely allowed to vote. The Pied Noir leadership endeavored to make sure that no free elections would ever occur in Algeria again. Starting in 1948, outright election rigging became the norm, and the term Algerian elections became synonymous with fraud. Algerians refused to cooperate with the designs of the European minority. In Dekma, the population all refused to vote. Gardes Mobiles arrived on the scene and opened fire on the populace, killing 7 people. The results of the quote-unquote election showed nearly all the seats of the new legislature belonged to loyal yes-men of the regime. In time, the handful of opposition members would be removed as well. In 1951, opposition candidates received 0 votes from the township of Djelfa, while the government's candidate received over 800 votes. This was impressive, as Djelfa was home to just 500 people. In short, it was fraud on a massive scale, and the idea of representative democracy in quote-unquote French Algeria was just as imaginary as the idea that Algeria could ever be a part of France. Abbas was still attempting to change the system from within. He lobbied passionately in mainland France and had a decent following behind him. His liberals believed in, quote, neither force nor submission, unquote. They still refused to accept that revolution had become necessary. Many had been educated in France, and others had French wives. Overall, however, they believed the destinies of Algeria and France were intertwined, and Algeria should remain a distinct entity while still maintaining its loyalty to France. Even amongst Abbas and his liberals, patience was beginning to run thin with the powers that be. One of the adherents of Abbas aptly explained, quote, "You showed us the way. You gave us the taste of liberty. And now when we say that we wish to be free, to be men, no more and no less, you deny us the right to take over your own formulas. You are Frenchmen, and yet you are surprised that some of us should seek independence." Unquote. In the underground, the Organisation Spéciale, or OS, was preparing for an armed uprising in Algeria. They were largely inspired by Mao and his treatise on guerrilla warfare. In it, he tells 2B militants that the people of the land are akin to the ocean. It was the job of militants to become the quote-unquote fish in this ocean, using the local people as a means of manpower, supply, and intelligence. Mao postulated that anyone, even those unsuited to warfare, could take up arms in a patriotic struggle. The OS launched its first and only successful raid against the central post office of Oran. Unfortunately, the OS was shoddily handled and easily infiltrated by French intelligence. It was dismantled and outlawed, while Ben Bella was arrested and sentenced to 8 years in French prison. Alongside a fellow militant, Ben Bella escaped his confines by sawing through the bars of his cell with a blade, which had been hidden in a loaf of bread. Although a total disaster, the failures of the OS would prepare a new group of young people for direct action against an oppressive government. In 1951, The major parties and factions of the Algerian nationalist movement met with the Algerian Communist Party to form a, quote, common front for the defense and respect of liberty, unquote. The Pied Noir responded by branding the entire association as a plot concocted by, quote, foreign communists, unquote. During a later meeting in 1953, the most militant of this group resigned, calling into question the direction of the movement and demanding armed struggle. In April of 1954, this splinter group formed the Comité Révolutionnaire de Unité et d'Action, or the CRUA. It appointed 9 leaders, remembered as the Nuits Historiques. Their names were Hossein Ait Ahmed, Ahmed Ben Bella, Mostafa Ben Bouled, Larbi Ben Mehdi, Rabah Bitat, Mohamed Boudayaf, Murad Dedouche, Mohamed Kaider, and Belkacem Krim. With an average age of just 32, they were all committed revolutionaries. They believed direct action was all that was left, as all other legal means had been attempted and failed in the face of racism, reactionary government, and state-sanctioned violence. Belkacem Krim was a Kabylie. His father was one of the hated yes-men in the French regime. He refused to follow in his father's footsteps and became an ardent Algerian nationalist. Summoned by the authorities, he decided it was better to flee into the desert. With nothing but a World War II-era Sten gun, he became something of a folk legend to Algerians. By the start of the general revolt, he was at the head of an armed band, 500 strong. Krim was always interested in maintaining his theater's autonomy and insisted leadership amongst the 9 should be shared collectively. This was reluctantly accepted, and the Algerian Revolution became a collective effort. This was both a blessing and a curse for the Algerian nationalist movement. On one hand, it gave the movement the elasticity it needed to resist continued French attempts at dismantling the revolution from the top down. On the other hand, it made way for the creation of cliques like the one Krim was building, which were incredibly powerful. This resulted in violence between Algerians, both during and following the war. On October 10th, 1954, the CRUA gave a name to its military wing, the Front de Libération Nationale, or FLN, was born. In preparation for the impending revolution, the nationalists split the country into 6 separate wilayas, or autonomous zones. In Algiers, an entire network of bomb factories was set up in the Kasbah, or marketplace, as well as in the town of Souma. Zubir Boujadj was in charge of this crucial vilayet. He was a man who held a deep grudge against France from an early age. His father was killed fighting in World War I, and as a result, he and his mother suffered a life of intense poverty. Zubir blamed the French for his and his family's suffering. All across Algeria, the final preparations were made for All Saints' Day 1954, designated as D-Day by the FLN. Weapons were painstakingly smuggled in pieces, and then assembled at designated meeting points. In total, Ben Bella asserts that in 1954, the entire revolution had just 400 weapons at its disposal. None of these initial weapons were provided by the Soviet Union, nor by any other socialist state. The closest ally the FLN had, at least at first, was the president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Since 1952, he had voiced his support for North African independence and endorsed the creation of the United Arab Republic, which for a time saw the states of Egypt and Syria combined into one nation. Nasser promised vast amounts of supply and weaponry for the revolutionaries, even promising to deploy Egyptian troops. However, much of Nasser's rhetoric was bluster of the highest order. He hoped to bluff the European powers into autonomy. This did not work. In any case, Egyptian aid to Algeria would be slow in arriving. Nasser wanted the FLN to, quote, start the revolution first, then aid will follow, unquote. Throughout Pied Noir communities and in mainland France, most Europeans remained ignorant to the plight of the Algerian people. They assumed French rule in Algeria would last forever, and that they would never be forced to flee the homes they had built on stolen land. Spite of European ignorance, the deck was clearly stacked against the Algerian Revolution. In every category, in all comparisons, the French military was supposed to be more than a match for anything the Algerian resistance could raise. The only advantage the native people had lay in their knowledge of their terrain and in the strength with which they were imbued when fighting for their country. As bullets flew and bombs exploded, leaflets were distributed by the revolutionaries. They read, quote, "To the Algerian people, to the militants of the national cause. After decades of struggle, the national movement reached its final phase of fulfillment. A group of responsible young people and dedicated militants gathered about it, the majority of wholesome and resolute elements, has judged that the moment has come to take the national movement out of the impasse into which it has been forced by the conflicts of persons and influence, and to launch it into the true revolutionary struggle at the side of the Moroccan and Tunisian brothers. Our movement of regeneration presents itself under the label of Front de Libération Nationale, freeing itself from any compromise and offering to all Algerian patriots of every social position and of all parties the possibility of joining the national struggle. Goal: national independence through 1. Restoration of the Algerian state, sovereign, democratic, and social within the framework of the principles of Islam. 2. Preservation of all fundamental freedoms without distinction of race or religion. Internal objectives: 1. Political house cleaning through the destruction of the last vestiges of corruption and reformism. External objectives: 1. Internationalism of the Algerian problem. 2. Pursuit of North African unity in its national, Arabo-Islamic context. 3. Assertion through the United Nations Charter of our active sympathy towards all nations that may support our liberating action. Means of action, by every means, until the realization of our goal." Unquote. The address closes, quote, "Algerians, we invite you to meditate on our charter set out above. It is your duty to associate yourself with it, to save our country, and to give it back its liberty. The Front de Libération Nationale is your front. Its victory is yours." Unquote. On the next episode of the Turning Tides podcast, the FLN will begin a war with one of the most powerful militaries on Earth, which was also supported by an immense amount of U.S. foreign military aid. Armed with only a rifle, FLN militants would bring the fight directly to the cumbersome French army of Algeria, which would have to adapt their tactics to face this modern threat, or face another humiliating defeat, as well as the end of over a century of French occupation of North Africa. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm your host, Joseph Pescone. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.